Greetings, this is Hear Her Sports, the podcast for everyone who loves stories by and about female athletes and other women in sport. I'm your host, Elizabeth Emery. Welcome. My guest today is Beth Rodden, one of the best rock climbers of all time. Among other things, she has achieved a number of notable free climbs on El Capitan, the 3,000-foot monolith in Yosemite National Park, and has also established the hardest first descent of a crack climb ever done by a woman on the route called Meltdown. Beth has written her first book called A Light Through the Cracks, A Climber's Story. I really enjoyed the book as a story about climbing, being a mom athlete, and how she made her way as a woman in a man's world. Beth is clearly an exceptional athlete, and she is also a regular person. Beth begins the memoir with her much-publicized kidnapping while climbing in Kyrgyzstan in 2000 with three other climbers. Throughout the book, she interweaves stories about what happened after they escaped, fear, hardcore training, big goals, anxiety, love and not love, climbing as a mom in a changing body, and as an older athlete. The book is available for pre-order to ship on May 1st. I'd much appreciate it if you order through our bookshop page at hearhersports.com/books. In our conversation, Beth speaks to me about the book, Climbing, of seeing strength in young female rock climbers now, Red S, the beauty of sports, and she compares climbing to golf and writing. I have spent a little bit of time climbing, and even though it wasn't something that clicked with me, I learned a ton about myself and balance in the year that I did. It's also a sport that just fascinates me. It was a real pleasure and an incredible honor to have this opportunity to talk with Beth. I could have talked to her for a very long time. She was thoughtful, interesting, and super nice. I hope you enjoy the show, learn something, and maybe even get inspired to try rock climbing yourself. So let's meet Beth Rodden. Well, hello, and welcome to Hear Her Sports, Beth. It is really great to have you here. I'm so excited. We have a lot to talk about.
Oh, thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
Well, you know, I'm going to sort of jump right into the book. You recently wrote this wonderful book, Light Through the Cracks. The last chapter of the book is from 2020. Could you, just to get us going, update us? You know, like what's happened since then, where you are with your climbing or training or whatever you're calling it at this point, maybe other areas of your life, anything that you want to update us on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would just say kind of a boring, more of the same. I still climb as much as I can. I feel like I climb at my best day on, day off, so I do that, but and I still get injured, you know, off and on, and still splitting my time between Yosemite and the Bay Area, and still traveling when I can to climb. So it's nothing earth-shaking has happened since the end of the book, but that's kind of nice, honestly.
One of the main topics of the book is, well, there are a lot of main topics. one of them is that you had a baby, you're now a mom. I'm curious about what it was like for you to get back into climbing, to being physically active, and also how it sort of shifted what your thoughts are, because that was a big part of the story that you told.
Yeah, no, that was a very pivotal part in my life, honestly, because it was probably the first time in my adult life that I really didn't feel like I had to control my body in a certain way for performance. I started to see my body and what it was capable of and appreciate it in a different light. And that answer kind of makes it seem all, you know, sunshine and roses or whatnot. But it was this slow transformation of starting to unwind kind of this inner dialogue that I had woven throughout my climbing career on what I expected my body to do, what I hoped my body could do. And so after we had our kiddo, getting back into climbing was slow for me. I had a pretty hard physical postpartum, and like I had a prolapse and severe mastitis infections and that sort of thing. So it took me a long time. I had friends that literally, you know, gave birth and then were climbing that same week. And that was not my experience. But I just took it quite slow and tried to be really patient with my body. and was pretty surprised, you know, as the years went on, that on what it could still do and what it was capable of.
I think it's interesting that you say that you came back slowly, because I've heard so many stories of women who say a similar thing, and it always sounds to me apologetic. Like, oh, you know, like everybody else came back really quick, but I was slow. However, I hear, as I said, I hear a lot of the slow stories too.
Yeah, totally. And I think for me, probably, I was just, my immediate friend group who I was surrounded with had a much different postpartum and getting back into climbing and that sort of thing. So I felt like a bit of an outcast, but, you know, I started sharing about it and then heard all sorts of people having similar experiences with having to take their time to get back into it.
I know you've always been hard on your body when you were training. Did you have a similar attitude, or did being pregnant shift that for you?
A similar attitude when I came back from it?
Well, no, during the whole, I guess the question is sort of like, at what point did you start thinking, like, I can have a little bit more grace or forgiveness?
I feel like that started, but ever so slightly, in pregnancy. And I actually don't think it really took effect until, or not even, I shouldn't say that because it kind of feels like when I say that I have it all figured out, but I feel like it didn't start to grow, you know, for several years into motherhood. You know, as I started to see, you know, how my body wasn't changing back into what I had hoped it would, I think that's when the true appreciation really started. And, you know, it's still like a journey and it's still something that I work on. But yeah, I feel like it was a few years into the motherhood journey that whole inner dialogue really started. Pregnancy felt like a 9-month, I don't want to say vacation because it's obviously not a vacation, but like a 9-month break that I could give myself, because obviously I couldn't be climbing my hardest when I was pregnant. But when, after, you know, our kiddo was born, I think I just expected, honestly, I expected that I would bounce back right away, that I would get back into it. You know, I was a professional athlete after all. And so I feel like that acceptance really didn't start for several years down the line when I thought, oh, wait, maybe my body isn't going to, quote unquote, bounce back. Maybe this is me now. And, you know, learning to see that in a different light instead of kind of in spite.
Did you feel like after you gave birth, did you feel like you did a lot to try to get back to your pre-shape and it wasn't working? I mean, like, what was that like, that period of sort of, okay, I'm trying, it's not going so great. Or it's not going as I expected.
Yeah, no, definitely. Once I kind of recovered from the hard physical postpartum, like once my prolapse symptoms started to ease up, you know, which honestly was a year postpartum, you know, I started running and I started climbing again and lifting weights and doing all the things that had traditionally worked for me. And my body was just different. I didn't expect that. I thought that it would respond the same way it always had. But there's just so much when, you know, in the early stages of motherhood, and I fully was subscribing to the need to bounce back and, you know, do all the things all the time and say yes to everything. But there's just so much vulnerability there. And I don't think I was prepared for that. I know I wasn't prepared for that. And so, you know, at the same time that I'm running and lifting weights and training and climbing, I'm also not sleeping that much. And I also have, you know, a whole new human to care for. And so, you know, I'm sure there's many reasons for it, but my body didn't respond how I thought it would. And so at some point I was like, well, you can continue to be at war with your body, or, you know, maybe this is something that needs to change, not only inside of you, but in our climbing community or in the sports community for women.
Yeah, that was my next question. It's like, you know, like how would you recommend that women who are athletes and get pregnant, like how can we go into it sort of like with changed expectations or no expectations, or I don't know, what would you recommend?
I mean, I think for me, I can only speak to me, but
sure.
For me, it would have been so much, it would have been such a huge help to hear the spectrum of experiences, right? Like I heard what was championed in my community, which was, look how long she climbed for pregnant. You know, she climbed into her 9th month and she was climbing really hard, or look how many pull-ups she can still do, or whatnot. And then postpartum, I heard the stories that were championed there, you know, like, oh, she was climbing 1 week later and she's climbing just as hard as she was or whatnot. And so that's what I heard. And so that's what I kind of expected. And I think if I would have heard the other stories of, you know, postpartum depression or physical challenges with postpartum. Like I literally had no idea what a prolapse was. And, you know, not from the medical community, not from the sports community. All I knew is that like I couldn't stand upright without severe pain and feeling like everything was going to fall out. And I didn't even understand what mastitis was, and just all the things. And so I feel like women for so long have kind of fit into this box on what to talk about after pregnancy, you know, how they're valued. And so to see the spectrum of everything would have really been helpful to me to feel like I wasn't so alone, because, you know, for me, I was just like, wow, I'm the only one. And I felt pretty ashamed of it. I felt really ashamed of my body, that it wasn't doing this thing that all my friends had been able to do without these complications. And so just hearing that that's normal, like, would have really helped me.
So interesting that we sort of jumped from women athletes basically retiring or leaving the sport when they got pregnant, you know, for lack of support or lack of understanding or lack of role models, to this new version of, you know, like the super body mom who mm-hmm. can, as you said, climb until the 9th month and a week later they're climbing again.
Yeah. No, it's wild. It's like one end of the spectrum to the other, you know, there's no in between.
Right.
It's like you either do nothing or you have to do everything.
At the end of the book, there was a line that I'm going to quote that I really enjoyed. It says, "I was startled to realize I could still perform in my body with all its changes." Can you describe a little bit more about how you got there and what that actually means?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I remember that time in that it was this year where I stopped trying to actively lose the weight that I had gained. You know, I had always been a really consistent weight because I manipulated my body and my eating that way. But at some point, I was like, okay, I'm going to try and stop losing this weight because, one, it's not working, and two, it's just creating this war between myself and my body, and that's not the type of person I want to be for my family or for, you know, the young girl climbers that I see at the gyms. And so that time in my life, once I had tried to really make a conscious effort to stop losing the weight and just climb and just try and climb as hard as I could in that body, it really surprised me, honestly. I was so convinced for so long, so much of my career, that it was impossible to do these things without having this like strict, rigid control and a certain number on the scale. And so once I was able to perform and do things that I hadn't been able to do when I, you know, long before pregnancy, it really kind of opened my eyes, and it was like this physical proof that maybe I needed, you know.
Do you still have those moments of surprise when you're climbing?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I have them all the time. Honestly, I had one yesterday, I think, when I was climbing. I just haven't been climbing that much because my prolapse symptoms returned late this past fall. And you know, I'm in my mid-40s now, and I was climbing these climbs that I had done 8 or 9 years ago. And I remember them being so difficult. And I was able to do them, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting, you know, even in my mid-40s and not having climbed much because I'm dealing with this pelvic floor injury. And it's surprising, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah.
One of the topics that we talk about a lot on Hear Her Sports is Red S. And you, like, tiny touched it in the book, but you never really mentioned Red S. Do you think about that? And if you had Red S when you were in, you know, like, training?
You know, I never went to the doctor or got tested, but I definitely had disordered eating when I was at my peak of climbing. And not even when I was at my peak. It started probably my first year in climbing and went, honestly, all the way through probably when I, you know, a little bit before I got pregnant or a couple years before I got pregnant. So into my early 30s. And yeah, it was just so prevalent in the climbing community, you know, and never talked about. And for me, I saw it as this extra strength that I had, you know. I saw it as like being more disciplined than other people and this other tool that I could use. But I never, you know, talked about it because I never wanted to admit it because I never thought it was a problem. I just thought it was an asset at that time.
Do you think that the climbing world and maybe the sporting world is starting to think about this a little bit more?
Absolutely. I think just the fact that people are talking about it openly is a huge step. And I know in climbing, there's a very conscious effort to address it somehow at higher levels, you know, in the sanctioning body for the competition federations. And I don't know if it's a very new thing for climbing to try and do that. So I don't know how effective it is or it will be or what's been happening with that. But just the fact that climbers, past and present, are talking about it, are addressing it. Obviously, nobody can be in anyone's body except themselves. But at least in pictures and in videos that are out there now, the body types look much different than they did when I was climbing, especially when I first started climbing.
No, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I would also expect, you know, hearing from you that you can climb now in this new body that you have would help as well.
Yeah. And, you know, just seeing these much stronger looking females, you know, instead of just these very, and I was one of them, stickly. I don't know that, you know, body types, just very wafer thin is probably a better word to describe it. but yeah, you know, just wafer thin. And now it's just, you see so much more strength, you know, and obviously like the women are pushing the sport forward leaps and bounds. So I think for girls growing up now, they have a much different visual role model than when I started climbing. And hopefully that helps.
Well, also a much broader range. I mean, sort of going back to the motherhood topic, you know, a much broader range of what is possible.
Absolutely. You know, in the 10 or so years it's been since I was pregnant, it was very rare for female climbers to continue to be sponsored and to continue to be able to maintain their career. And now it's very common. It's, you know, most women don't stop climbing. They don't retire. They don't fade away like I saw when I was younger. And so it's been a huge change in that regard.
The This is a short break to encourage you to order all of your books via our bookshop page at hearhersports.com/books. On our main bookshop page, find recommendations from guests and even books they've written, like A Light Through the Cracks, A Climber's Story, written by today's guest, Beth Rodden. Ordering from Bookshop is easy. I know it's not free two-day shipping. I do get that. However, speed is not everything. They support local bookstores, and your orders support Hear Her Sports podcast. A small portion of your entire purchase goes directly to us. Find out more and order at hearhersports.com/books or from the Books tab at hearhersports.com.
There is no hood like parenthood. When you meet a fellow parent, you just kind of get each other on a whole nother level. Hi, I'm Kanika Chanda Gupta. I'm a former CNN journalist, mom of three, including twins, and host of That's Total Mom Sense, the podcast. I interview changemakers on their life lessons, legacy, and superpower of intuition, aka their mom sense and dad sense. I've had some pretty amazing parents on my show.
Hey, what's up? I'm Kelly Rowland.
Hi, this is Chelsea Clinton.
It's me, Bobby Brown. Can't wait to share my story.
Episodes release every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and on YouTube. Join my tribe at thatstotalmomsense.com and follow me on Instagram at Kanika Chanda Gupta. I'm thrilled to be on this journey with you.
And now, let's get back to mom and climber extraordinaire, Beth Rodden, to find out more about her new book, A Light Through the Cracks. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your book. Maybe, like, what sticks with you since you've written the book? You know, like, what topics that are mentioned in the books? Because it really is a very rich book. Like, what sticks with you? What do you like to talk about?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I'm happy to talk about anything. I think it covered such a long, you know, big chunk of my life that there's so many different things in there. You know, obviously coming from dealing with trauma and PTSD to climbing at the top of my sport to motherhood, you know, I think it's just... it's the type of story that I always really get immersed in, you know, it's somebody's life, but their whole life, you know, and that's what I really latch onto is seeing the whole person, not just necessarily one story of their life.
Well, you certainly opened yourself up. Why write the book?
You know, that's a good question that I think I've been asking myself quite a bit lately, now that it is an actual physical thing that people are gonna read instead of just this tab open on my computer that I went to for nearly 10 years to work on. But I think I always come back to, I would have really appreciated a book like this at many different points in my life. I would have loved to have had a book like this to read when I was a teenager, when I was an angsty 20-year-old, when I was a 30-year-old or going through a divorce or falling in love or a new mom. I just, I feel like at least in the climbing community, and I think a lot of times in the sports community, there's like the typical hero's journey, you know, that is always celebrated. And so to see and to read books, like I said, you know, earlier, that just showed a wide range of the human experience would have really helped me, I think. And so that's why I originally started to write it. And so that's what I'm holding on to now, even though part of me wishes it still was just a tab on my computer.
Right. I mean, people are actually going to be able to read it soon.
Yeah, no, I know. It's happening.
Yeah. Well, what I liked about it was that, A, you actually wrote it. You know, like you got it done. And it seemed to me all about speaking up and speaking out and being public with these things that, as you say, normally are not written about or written about in a very hero's way. And instead, you know, you're very open about all your foibles. And the whole book is sort of running through this period of trying to figure things out, which I really, really liked.
Thank you. Yeah.
And before we get on to some of the other topics in the book, one of the things that I also really liked is that your descriptions of climbing are some of the best I've ever read. I mean, the best at explaining the appeal of what it's like. I especially liked your writing about the puzzle of climbing, but also the details about shoe stickiness or expanding yourself or contorting, the rock face, the weather that changes the type of rock or the characteristics of the rock. I found the explanations really intriguing, but also understandable. I mean, I've climbed, but certainly not very much.
Well, thank you. Well, that thanks should go to one of the people, Mark, who helped me with the book, because when he first read it, he said, "This is really good. However, you have zero climbing in here." Because I was just interested in all the other stuff, writing about the other right. stuff. And I, you know, I just live climbing, and I'm like, I don't need, that's so boring to hear about climbing. And so he was like, explain it to me like I'm 4 years old and like what you love about it. And so I just, it was the first time I've ever done that, honestly, that I've ever kind of just, you know, gone straight in and head first and just really immersed myself in my brain on like how I approach climbing, why I climb, what it feels like, all that sort of thing. And it was a fascinating experience for me, honestly. But at first I was like, that's boring. I'm not going to write about that.
Yeah. But it's interesting that you said that, you know, like you had to go back to do it because it did seem so natural. And it also seemed like it was something that you thought about all the time.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, it's just, it's interesting climbing. It's when I think about it, when I really put myself in the moment when I'm climbing, there's like clearly a lot of things that are going on to make me get up the climb. But at the same time, it honestly feels very natural and comes very naturally. And so, whereas something else, you know, like writing or, you know, public speaking or something, it's something that I really have to consciously work at, if that makes sense. Like I have to practice certain things. And with climbing, obviously, like I had to train it, and I had to train my muscles to be stronger and my fingers to work in a certain way. But I never really had to train how to really tap really deep and try really hard. Like that just came. And so to write about something that comes so naturally just felt, it was really a fascinating experience, honestly.
But did the understanding of rock face and shoe stickiness, did that come also?
You know, that's a good question. I feel like that's something that at least my circle of friends and climbers that I'm around, it's like we talk about that like we talk about the weather.
Right.
It's
right,
very, right. It's, you know, we talk about our skin and if it's wet today or if it's dry today or if we need to take one more rest day, or we talk about, do you need stiffer shoes or do you need more supple shoes? So that's kind of probably a bit more nuanced to climbing, but then also probably even more nuanced to who I surround myself in climbing, and that we can really geek out on the intricacies of that type of thing.
I have to think about this more because, you know, when somebody's good at a sport, I'm wondering if that kind of stuff just naturally starts to make sense because they're so into it and they're trying to, you know, again, it goes to this puzzle, but you're trying to figure out how to get better. So, okay, like what are my fingers feeling like? What is the rock feeling like today? And how is it different from before? I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe it just does come naturally as part of the process.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that I learned, and I would just, you know, when I was young, I was just like a sponge and I would absorb things. And I think it's something that the climbers that I was always surrounded with would always just talk about all the time, you know, just like, what are we having for breakfast? Or like, what shoes are you going to wear or whatnot, you know, or is it humid today? Or is the sun going to be on the rock type of thing? So it's probably like, you know, a golfer watching their, knowing where the wind is blowing or something like that. Obviously they're taking it into account, but maybe it's not as big of an undertaking as, you know, somebody who doesn't know how to take the wind into account or doesn't know how to take if the grass is wet into account and how that's going to make your ball roll or something like that. So Yeah, I feel like that, you know, might be sport specific. And it also might be, you know, I think it's also climber specific. I think some people don't really like to get into the weeds with that stuff. But I I feel like it's just all part of the puzzle to solve. And I really like that part of it.
Mm-hmm. I love the weeds.
Yeah.
In any sport.
It's so fun to me.
Can you describe more about the puzzle of climbing?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I felt like working on the book was kind of similar to working on a climbing project. And I'm sure you could, this is probably, you know, a comparison you could make to a lot of different things. But for me, when I approach a climb, you know, it's like I have this 50 foot piece of rock, and there are 70 holds to choose from. And somehow you have to come up with a sequence of where you put your feet, in what order you put your hands, in what order you move your feet, in what order you place the gear, how fit you need to be to, you know, how much endurance you need to have in your forearms, how much power you need to have in your arms to be able to do each move. And it was kind of like that with the book, in that obviously, like, there's this blank slate and you're thinking, well, what am I going to put in to put these sequences together? There's three parts of the book. And I remember on the third part, you know, there's all these ideas on what to put in there. And so it's like you start outlining those ideas, and then you start, you know, writing each story for each idea, and then you cut some of them out and you weave them together. And it's just like that in climbing. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to use that handhold over on the right because then it takes me too far right. So I'm going to try and make this work. And it's just really, I just love that part of it. It's like, how can I work with what I have to get up the rock? And what can I do with my body, and how do I need to make it stronger in this area or more flexible in that area to make that work?
I'm going to reveal my complete ignorance of climbing, but one of the most fascinating parts of reading your book was this sort of idea of a climbing project of, okay, I want to get up this thing, and I'm going to go back to the rock over and over and over and over for however long it takes to get up that rock. And that to me was fascinating, just that work involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really taken with that part of it, with refining things and doing that. And I think it's always so interesting to me to go from day one, you know, where maybe you can do 10% of the problem. And that's probably a good day, honestly. But you kind of can understand like what your body might be capable of. And so then over however many days or weeks or months or whatever, you're able to slowly chip that higher and higher. It's like 10% and then maybe 15%. And then you might go backwards and, you know, have to go to 14% and then leap ahead to 30%. And so just that whole refining the thing and learning it and working out each piece of the puzzle, you know, sometimes off of a 50-foot piece of climb, I'll spend all day on 4 feet. You know, and just really working out that 4 feet. And I don't know, I'm getting excited thinking about it because it's just so fun.
But, you know, I think on the outside it can look like, oh, she just goes to the rock and she climbs it. And
nobody
understands that there's all this, you know, stuff that happened months and months and months beforehand. And there is all that work. And, you know, I think it's easy to look at that, oh, she just goes up there and climbs it, and think, oh, I can't do that.
Yeah. No, and I mean, that's the beauty and curse of most sports, right? Like you watch Katie Ledecky swim and you're like, oh, it's just because she's a good swimmer. But it's like, you don't see the hours upon hours upon hours every week that she puts in refining her stroke and learning this and learning that, and probably like testing out different swimsuits and, you know, like all that sort of thing goes into this beautiful, you know, swimmer when she's swimming. It's just like, she's just, in my opinion, you know, just beautiful to watch swim. And so I think that's the cool thing about sports, is there's so much that goes on behind and before the performance.
Right, exactly. Well, I want to talk a little bit about sponsorship and women in the men-dominant world. And like one example in your book that I marked was when you stopped to see a sponsor during a road trip that you were taking with Tommy Caldwell. And he basically was sitting there simply as a witness when you finally got a raise from your sponsors. You had been trying to get this raise for several months. And I thought that was really fascinating, just, you know, like having this like almost silent support. And so I'm curious, you know, like where you are now with your sponsors, what your relationships are, and maybe like a bigger discussion of how things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed drastically in the nearly 30 years that I've been in the sport. And, you know, I've been sponsored nearly that long as well. It started, you know, obviously with just a gear sponsorship and grew into being paid. So now there are more women, you know, equal, as many on each team as men, a lot. Whereas when I was first started, there was, you know, a slot for one or two on a sponsored team. And then, you know, when I was married to Tommy, who was at the top of the sport, and I was at the top of the sport, I was consistently paid. And a lot of times we had similar sponsors. We probably had half the same sponsors and half different. I was consistently paid a third less than him from sponsors. And at the time, you know, I was just grateful for what I got. Now, Tommy and I aren't married anymore, and I don't know what the men get paid versus the women, but I do hear that it's much more equitable. So I feel like it has come a long way, which is great. And I think that it should just keep getting more equitable, so it's never even a consideration when there's a woman and a man on the team. If they're both, you know, performing equally as well, I feel like, why would you pay one less than the other?
I love that you mentioned that. I mean, and this is pretty old school at this point, but, you know, women, there only being one seat at the table, and so we all had to fight for that one seat, and then it became, you know, like this vision of catfighting and stuff. So I love that you brought that topic back up.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was a huge thing that shaped my relationship and my friendships with females for, you know, decades, two decades, a decade and a half. And that I saw them, these women that were climbers that, you know, you would naturally think that I would be friends with, and we were friendly, but I also viewed them as my competition because there were only so many slots for us all to fit into. And so now it's definitely changed. And the younger generation, at least from the outside, again, I can't speak to it because I'm not them, but it seems much less competitive, much less cutthroat in that way to, you know, vie for that one seat. They're very supportive of each other. They, you know, really root for each other. And it's pretty wonderful to see compared to what I grew up with.
Do you still have sponsors?
Yes, I am still sponsored. Yeah.
And like, what are they looking for from you now that's different from what they were looking for from you, you know, 20 years ago?
Yeah. So it's interesting in that climbing, I don't feel like there's one way to make it as a climber professionally, which is kind of a nice thing. But back then, you know, I got paid for pushing the sport, the level of the sport higher, and for being in magazines because of the ascents that I was doing and these notable climbs that I was establishing or repeating. And now, you know, I haven't been at the top of the sport in a very long time. And so my sponsors and I have found worth in other ways in what I'm doing and shedding light on a lot of topics that have just been left in the shadows and really trying to be a spokesperson for climbing and make it a more equitable place.
Do you enjoy telling your story now more or less than you did? I mean, how are you feeling in this role?
Yeah, I do still enjoy what I do. And I think I'm grateful for that. And I think that at some point, if I don't still enjoy what I do, then hopefully I would, you know, try and find something that's next. But right now, it does feel good to me and it does feel important. And I do really enjoy what I'm doing right now.
Do you like being on social media?
That is a good question. I don't like the pressures of social media, if that makes sense. Not in the way that I think that might come off, in that, you know, I think social media, it's been proven to be very terrible for young people because of social pressures. For me, the thing that's hard is it's so, it's looked at so much for worth in athletes, if that makes sense. Because it's just so hard to gauge monetary value. It has always been hard to gauge monetary value for an athlete, I think, because it's like, how do you tell if they're having an impact? It's just hard to put a number value on marketing. So I don't like that. I really liked, you know, when it was just telling your story or sharing certain things and not worrying about how many people, you know, see it or whatnot. But I feel like I've tried to kind of remove myself from that on my better days and just be like, well, if companies see value in me, then it doesn't necessarily matter. So I think it's like, I like social media for a lot of reasons, in that I like the connection that it's made with people that I don't think I ever would have been connected with. I don't like social media in that it's just maybe some more performance anxiety, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it certainly gives the broader perspective that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a very open-ended question, but one of the things I was left with after reading your book is sort of this contrast of seeking excellence. And I think that is even a phrase that's in your book, is seeking excellence versus sort of a boring life. And I don't know where the question is, but did the seeking excellence leave, or has it changed, or like, how are you melding the two, or I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I don't feel like I'm one of those people that I'm like, I'm healed, you know, even with trauma or eating issues or anything. I feel like I'm a human and those things might, you know, always live in me to some regard. And same with seeking excellence. However, I feel like my incredibly tight grip on that and control has been loosened tremendously.
In what way? Like, how are you managing the two? And what does that look like?
I mean, I feel like, you know, having a kid, it's kind of hard to maintain a tight grip of control because you have another human with you. You know, just, I feel like just with life, I'm just trying to let life happen a little bit more rather than control it. And it's easier said than done, right? But I'm less wanting to just try and control everything and realize that, you know, life is going to be messy and that's part of it. And it can be, honestly, one of the joys of it.
Right. You did write a book, though.
I did write a book.
Seeking Excellence.
Yeah.
One of the things you said in our email contact before we got on the phone is that you think a lot about what to cook for dinner each day. I have to find out more about what you meant.
Oh, I mean, it's just, you know, every day at like 4 p.m. I'm like, this is one of the hardest parts of my day. I'm like, what am I going to, do I need to go to the grocery store? Oh God, am I going to be able to do it before we're all too hungry? It's just like, it's a big chore every day. It's a big decision.
Well, I totally agree. And I have the same big chore. I was hoping you had some joy in cooking dinner each day. And that was what it was about.
Oh, I mean, I do enjoy cooking. It's not like some necessarily peaceful time. I feel like it's peaceful actually when we're at my parents' house, because then like all the cousins can play and my husband and I can just cook together, which is honestly one of my favorite things in life. But, you know, that's a rare day in every year. That's not every day.
And you also pointed out that when you cook, you also have to have the ingredients, which means going to the grocery store, which is
exactly.
A lot less joyous.
It is very much less joyous.
Well, wrapping up, what would you like us to take away from your book?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I have no idea. You'd think I would have an answer. I'm just honestly honored when anyone would take the time to read it. Because, you know, taking the time to read a book is a big investment for people. And so for someone to do that is, you know, it's a big honor for me.
Well, I hope everybody does. It's excellent.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, that was really a wonderful conversation. Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
And that's it for our show today. Thank you to Beth for being on Hear Her Sports podcast. I'm grateful for her time and for her thoughtful conversation. Please read Beth's new book, A Light Through the Cracks. It is terrific. I'd love it if you order it through Hear Her Sports bookshop page at hearhersports.com/books. Once you are on our page, a small percentage of everything you order supports the show. Your order does help us out with the production costs of making Hear Her Sports. So thank you for ordering from Bookshop. If you are interested in episodes with somewhat similar themes, I would suggest the following. Dr. Margot Mountjoy, who talks about some changes in rock climbing rules to address Red S. Another superstar climber, Sasha DeJulian. And of course, mountain bike racer and new mother, Madeline Detman. I will continue talking to mom athletes in the coming months. Sign up for the newsletter to keep up to date on when the episodes post. Find all the episodes on your favorite podcast player or at hearhersports.com. Also on the website, find ways to reach me. Browse through the show notes and support the podcast through Bookshop, Buy Me a Coffee, and our new affiliate, Naboso, who make wonderful insoles with little feet sensitizing nubs on them. Thank you for listening. I so appreciate it. I appreciate your interest in female athletes and women's sports. I appreciate your time and attention. Thank you for choosing Hear Her Sports podcast today. The best way to support the show is to tell your friends, colleagues, and training partners about it. Hear Her Sports is a proud member of Evergreen Podcasts. Thank you to them and you for your ongoing support and for being part of the growth of women's sports. Until next time, bye-bye.
But yeah, we can go, I guess, and see where it takes us.
Sports stars. They're like superheroes.
But they're actually real.
Which is why we've made a podcast about them. You see,
they've all got a story.
But too many of these stories were cut short.
Kobe Bryant.
Payne Stewart.
Flo Jo.
Phil Hughes.
Justin Fashanu.
We're writing episodes about all of them.
And sadly, many more.
Death of a Sports Star, a new series from Crowd Network.